blast hit southern and eastern Afghanistan, leaving at least 4 security personnel dead and 10 others injured. The new U.S. administration repeats former President Barack Obama's campaign promise to close the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison. And Venezuela's president hails the U.S. call for the lifting of the U.S. and EU sanctions on the Latin American country, while the opposition blasts the report. Thanks for joining us. At least 4 security personnel have been killed and 10 others, including civilians, injured in a string of blasts in southern and eastern Afghanistan. Police say 4 security forces, including a commander, were killed after an explosion in the Chapadara district of eastern Kunar province. Separately, an explosive-laden vehicle ripped through a police outpost in Kandahar province, injuring 7 personnel, and a roadside blast injured 3 civilians in eastern Nangarhar province. No group has claimed responsibility, but Afghanistan has witnessed a rise in such assaults in recent days, with the government mostly blaming them on the Taliban. The violence surges despite ongoing talks between the militant group and the government to bring a lasting peace to the war-battered country. Massive inflation and unprecedented price hike has triggered violent protests in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Javed Rana reports from Islamabad.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence in government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
People in Myanmar have hit the streets for the 8th consecutive day to denounce a recent military coup amid growing anger over the arrest of activists. The rallies have been held in several cities, including the business hub Yangon. Protesters slammed security forces for raiding homes and detaining coup opponents. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, more than 320 people have been arrested since last week's coup. On Friday, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution calling on the Myanmarese military to release all of the detainees, including the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and hand over power back to civilian administration. The military seized power over allegations that the November parliamentary elections won by Suu Kyi's party with a landslide was fraudulent. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it seeks to close the Guantanamo Bay prison by the end of his term. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the closure of the notorious jail is, quote, certainly the administration's intention. Psaki says a process has been launched to examine steps towards this goal. Former President Barack Obama made a campaign promise in 2008 to shut down the detention facility, but failed to do so. His successor, Donald Trump, kept it open during his term. 40 inmates are still being held there for nearly two decades without charge or trial. The jail was set up following the 9/11 attacks in 2001 for foreign terror suspects. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says Biden faces an uphill task to close Guantanamo as U.S. security agencies see the facility as useful.
You have, you know, the Pentagon, the State Department, immigration, many other departments that will push back and say, no, it's very useful. We don't want to close it, because Barack Obama, after 8 years, failed to close Guantanamo Bay. So it is a very useful thing, but it's also abuse. You know, it's widespread torture, you know, detaining people without charge, without even evidence. So Biden, if he can do it, that's great. It would remove a great embarrassment for the United States. But unfortunately, I think the Pentagon, the CIA, American Immigration, and others see it as a very, very useful tool. They don't have to provide any sort of legal rights to the detainees. So it'll be interesting to see if Biden can make through with this promise. And we'll see if Guantanamo Bay, at least the security facilities, will in fact be closed down. But this is a great embarrassment, and it's a case where there's been widespread torture, waterboarding, and other things which have been held there that is as much to the shame of the United States they allowed it.
Tensions are running high in Haiti as demonstrators have taken to the streets once again to protest against President Jovenel Moïse in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Protesters accused Moïse of illegally extending his term in office. A similar rally on Thursday turned violent after police fired tear gas on demonstrators. Tensions escalated after the president tried to force out three judges who were proposed as potential interim national leaders to replace him, including the interim opposition leader, Joseph Lucien Jean-Louis. Moïse argues that he was sworn into office for a five-year term in 2017 and that his tenure will end on February 7th next year. However, the opposition says Moïse's term expired days ago, demanding to step down. The opposition stands accused of trying to kill the president and stage a coup against the government. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news. The UN envoy calls on the U.S. and the European Union to ease their sanctions on Venezuela, saying the measures have worsened the humanitarian situation in the country.
The economy's decline started in 2014 with the downturn in oil prices. Among other factors reported to affect the economy of Venezuela, unilateral sanctions increasingly imposed by the United States, the European Union, and other countries have exacerbated the above-mentioned challenges.
Duhan said the unilateral sanctions have had devastating effects on the basic human rights of Venezuelans, including the right to food, health, life, and education. She said the sanctions mainly affect those in extreme poverty. She called existing humanitarian exceptions for Venezuela ineffective and insufficient. The UN envoy made the comments following a 12-day visit to the South American country. The Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro hailed the UN move and called the sanctions coercive.
Today, the rapporteur of the UN has called on the U.S. government and the governments of the European Union to review the sanctions and lift the sanctions against Venezuela because they have exacerbated this gigantic, enormous humanitarian crisis against the people.
Opposition leader Juan Guaido's UN envoy, on the other hand, criticized Duhan's remarks as imprecise and a propaganda tool. The UN had previously called on Washington to lift its sanctions on Venezuela during the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. ambassador to Caracas, however, claims the economic crisis in Venezuela is due to its government's corruption. Dua Coleman is an author and journalist joining us from Paris, and we also have Angelo Giuliano, who's a political analyst joining us from Montreux. Welcome, Dua Coleman. Let me first come to you. Venezuela's economy obviously is battered on multiple fronts, but one of the main areas of its suffering, the way it is, in which the humanitarian situation falls under that, are the sanctions that have been imposed by the U.S. And as a result, deaths are occurring, and people are having a very hard time when it comes to just medicinal supplies overall. Can anything be done? Even this UN call by this envoy, is it going to get listened to, or is the status quo going to continue?
It's very difficult to get the United States and the European Union to lift sanctions. I mean, it is possible. Countries have managed to get sanctions eased in the past. But it takes an awful lot of pressure, and I don't see any reason why they would lift sanctions. The sanctions are basically a form of economic warfare, which the purpose of which is to basically make the government there cow down to European and American geopolitical and economic interests, and to give them a foothold in that region of the world. The whole reason for the sanctions in the first place is not because the government is corrupt or has stolen elections. It is because the government is simply not following the rule book laid down by Brussels and Washington. And that is the whole reason for, one of the major reasons in any case for the humanitarian crisis in the country. Venezuela has been forced to be more creative in its foreign policies because of the sanctions. And so, for example, we've seen an emerging geopolitical alliance with Turkey, where the Turks are exporting a lot of essential supplies to the country. They're getting a lot of their medical supplies from other countries like Turkey. They've had to increase ties with Russia, China, Iran, and other countries because of U.S. aggression. It's a very stupid policy from a U.S. point of view also, because they could have, if they had lifted the sanctions, they could have opened and normalized diplomatic relations with Caracas, and it would be better for everyone. But instead, they've decided to pursue this aggressive policy, which they do, of course, against any country that simply refuses to follow their orders. This really is a case of geopolitical insubordination that is the origin of this entire sanctions policy.
Angelo Giuliano, are you noticing a trend over here when it comes to sanctions? I mean, we're looking at Venezuela, and it has one of the largest reserves of oil. We're looking at Iran, who's been a victim of sanctions in the most extreme way. Even the U.S. says it's one of the worst sanction regimes ever exercised on a country in the history of sanctions. We also can take a look at how Russia has been sanctioned. Are these countries that are rich with natural resources, lack oil, being targeted in any sense?
Of course. I mean, the main reason is because of oil. But from experience, we've seen that sanctions have never worked. On the contrary, what happens with sanctions is people, they look for different ways to bypass the sanctions, and especially when the sanctions are by using the dollar. When countries cannot trade in dollars, they are going to find other alternatives. And this is going to backfire for the United States, because we are seeing a trend of de-dollarization, meaning that the day that the world will de-dollarize, meaning that the U.S. dollar will not have this hegemonic position, well, you could imagine a collapse of the U.S. because they are living on printing money and having a high standard, which is financed by the rest of the world. So these sanctions we've seen all along. On the contrary, what has happened is that you can see a block, anti-U.S. block being formed. You know, alliances that were unbelievable a long time ago, like Russia and China, now are among the strongest alliances. So basically, you can imagine a very strong bloc forming against the U.S.
Since we're talking about blocs, Joao Coleman, we're looking at, for example, the alliance that was formed, which was named BRICS, the BRICS countries, of which it has some major players in there. There's other alliances also. And the bigger question comes about is whether the U.S. and some of its allies and Western partners don't like these blocks because it goes against their interests, and hence some countries fall victim to their sanctions. Is that a proper analysis of it?
Well, regardless of who's in power in Washington, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, the basic policy, standard policy for Latin America is based on the Monroe Doctrine. And that doctrine states that Latin America essentially is to be controlled by the United States, and any other power that has close relations with Latin America interferes with U.S. interests. So U.S. interests not only cover the territory of the United States, but in fact extend right throughout all of the Americas. And so this is essentially the problem that Latin America, ever since its independence from the Spanish Empire, has never really become an independent continent. It has always become, it went from being part of the Spanish Empire to being an extension of the U.S. Empire. And so it has never achieved independence or sovereignty. And so the whole question of, you know, policy regarding Venezuela is to do with the fact that it is simply not following orders from Washington. If the United States changed policy, it would be actually in U.S. interest, because it would prevent a lot of the new alliances we see emerging, such as the ones I've mentioned with Turkey, Russia, China, Iran, and so on. But I think also, you know, there is a sense in which, in the same, just as in Iran, the U.S. kind of needs an enemy, and Venezuela has been a convenient enemy for the United States for its entire project of militarization. In this region, of course, oil is a major factor, not just in Venezuela, but in neighboring Guyana, where in the Essequibo region, it is believed there may be the biggest oil reserves in the world, and ExxonMobil are down there exploring. The opposition candidate that the West wants to install in Venezuela may be far more favorable to U.S. Oil interests in the region, that is to say Juan Guaido, the candidate they support. So that is the reason why they want to get him in, so that they can then dictate policy in the region.
Thank you so much for that. Angela Giuliano, political analyst from Montreux. Thank you, Jola Colmet, author and journalist there from Paris. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has rejected a claim by Britain, France, and Germany that Tehran is in breach of the 2015 nuclear deal. Zarif said that Iran's activities are in line with paragraph 36 of the nuclear deal. He added that the three European signatories, or E3, have done nothing to fulfill their obligations following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Zarif was reacting to a statement by the European signatories in which they called on Iran to halt producing uranium metal. The E3 also urged Tehran not to take any non-compliant steps. After Washington's pullout of the deal, the Europeans had pledged to take steps to compensate for the loss and facilitate money transactions. The E3 have taken no serious measures in this regard, nearly 3 years after the U.S.'s withdrawal and its unilateral sanctions against Iran. Senior U.S. lawmakers have urged the U.K. to help end both countries' role in Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. U.S. Senator Ron Wyden told the British media that Washington's allies, like the U.K. and France, should follow suit immediately and stop enabling the Saudi regime by selling weapons. Also, Senator Chris Murphy said the respective economic benefits of offensive weapon sales to Riyadh do not outweigh the moral responsibility to end, quote, complicity in this ongoing nightmare. In his first speech on foreign policy, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced last week that Washington would end support for the Saudi-led offensive in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians have been killed in a Saudi-led war in the Arab country since March 2015. And that is World News. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Every year, hundreds of Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. Estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
Deadliest mass shooting in American history.
They were just joining us. Two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. You can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopaths,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youth too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games, gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. A failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All of this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined. As if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned. By remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors were just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys? And not girls.
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that the violence in the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the vice president with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, we've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days and every single day.
On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're gonna learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm gonna kill you, Dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Come on, yes you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love, basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do, get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And, most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes, and also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
Andy Peel on KRES Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
In the groundbreaking film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, this memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African-American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men,
checkmate, boo-boo,
who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio, images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working-class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In American popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. But since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that.
I watched this movie 63 times.
It's a comic book.
So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. The American ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
But I haven't lost my temper in 40 years, but Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth, but I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
Don't move out of you, son. I'll fill your pants for a lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world, who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Or Batman. The body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Or the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years, the size of G.I. Joe's biceps, in real-life equivalents, increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's games. We've gone from the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is one more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We have all heard the famous saying, survival of the fittest, right? And when we talk about survival of the fittest, it is usually associated with being ruthless, with being selfish, with, you know, minding your own business, not getting distracted by life's drama, even if it means, you know, helping other people out, taking time out of your day, sacrificing your energy and your time and your work or whatever to help improve other people's lives and situations. Survival of the fittest means that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world and this and that. But even Darwin himself believed, who, by the way, studied human evolution, believed that mankind is not naturally or biologically competitive or that self-centered as we might think he is. As a matter of fact, Darwin believed that we are profoundly social beings, that caring and being kind is what's innate and biological about us. We are such social beings that I was reading an article a while back talking about a hospital where their nursery had a section basically that would take care of abandoned newborns, and they would take in volunteers to come and just hold these newborns and have skin-to-skin contact with them during the first few weeks of those newborns, those infants' development, because otherwise there was the fear of the infants dying if they could not have that human contact. That's how social we are. Now, what does that have to do with kindness? How about we listen to a short story on this matter and continue our discussion after that? Stay with us.
The hotel clerk who helped the couple. We have an interesting story for today. On a stormy night many years ago, an elderly man and his wife entered the lobby of a small hotel in Philadelphia, USA. The couple approached the front desk hoping to get some shelter for the night. "Could you possibly give us a room here?" the husband asked. The clerk, a friendly man, looked at the couple and explained that there were three conventions in town. "All of our rooms are taken," the clerk said. "But I can't send a nice couple like you out into the rain at night. Would you perhaps be willing to sleep in my room?" When the couple declined, the young man pressed on, "Don't worry about me. I'll make out just fine," the clerk told them. So the couple agreed. As he paid his bill the next morning, the elderly man said to the clerk, "You are the kind of manager who should be the boss of the best hotel. Maybe someday I'll build one for you." The clerk looked at them and smiled. 2 years passed. The clerk had almost forgotten the incident when he received a letter from the old man. He recalled that stormy night and enclosed a round trip ticket to New York, asking the young man to pay them a visit. The old man met him in New York and led him to the corner of 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Then he pointed to a great new building there, with watchtowers thrusting up to the sky. "That," said the old man, "is the hotel I have just built for you to manage." "You must be joking," the young man said. "I can assure you I'm not," said the old man. The old man's name was William Waldorf Astor, and that structure was the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The young clerk who became its first manager was George C. Bolt. This young clerk never foresaw the turn of events that would lead him to become the top man of one of the world's most glamorous hotels.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Now, obviously, we cannot be hope to be kind unless we socialize with other human beings. I can't lock myself up in a room and then describe myself as a kind person unless I have manifested that kindness in my interactions with other creatures, whether it's humans, whether it's plants, animals, environment, nature. So in order to express that kindness, I need to associate myself with other people and creatures, and most importantly, strengthen that quality and attribute within myself. It is very easy. It is very simple. It is even common sense to be kind toward those who are kind to me. But the Quran and Islam takes it a step further, because obviously Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam had been sent to complete the best of morals and ethics, right? So kindness is a moral act. Being kind toward those who aren't kind to me is the best of ethics and morals. And that is what the Quran teaches us. ادفع بالتي هي أحسن. If someone is unkind to me, if someone insults me, if someone hurts my ego and my pride, an act of kindness from me toward them will bring down the flame of rage, anger, and animosity between us and bring the hearts closer. I was reading through, I think, Psychology Today, and scientific researchers have shown that spending and devoting our resources on other people rather than mostly on ourselves brings about lasting well-being. And that's very interesting, because as the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam has said, only that which you spend on others will last for you. And my mind was blown. This is a literal hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And because they spoke the truth, after a while, science and research basically just come to the conclusion, the same conclusion and the same idea that they presented us with 1400 years ago. And aside from the fact that, well, they were infallible and whatever they said was wise, it is a natural, common sense human thing. And to understand that truth is within us. We were equipped with it. We were created with it. So obviously it would make sense. But to spend our energy and resources on other people brings us a greater sense of fulfillment and achievement rather than just spending it on ourselves. And that is the key point that will help with our growth and self-betterment. If I spend all my energy and focus on myself, again, I cannot claim to have any sort of moral or ethical virtues and merits within me because, well, I didn't do anything special. But once I am able to transcend and go beyond myself, step beyond my own nafs, my own wantings and yearnings and desires, and spend my energy on other people, their accomplishment. Now, I'm not saying neglect myself entirely, because as cliche as this may sound, it is true. You can't pour from an empty cup. We have to spend a certain amount of our lives working on ourselves, bettering ourselves, strengthening our resources before we're able of even thinking about spending them on others. That's why self-refinement is so important in the teachings of Islam. That's why we're constantly taught to have muraqabah and have a sense of awareness and self-consciousness toward the things that we do, the thoughts that cross our minds. Are we kind enough to ourselves to be kind toward other people? And that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.